Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. I'm glad you came by. Well, today is going to be week in review. The reason for that is because yours truly is headed back home very early tomorrow morning. I'm riding back to Florida with a friend that I met at the other institute. So she and her son are going to pick me up on their way from Ontario. So at least I don't have to get back on the infamous train from hell. So I thought we'd review this week since I won't be here tomorrow and even give Shell an opportunity to sleep in. Let's bring her in. Good morning, honey.
Good morning, Renee. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing good.
That's good. So I thought we'd just talk about like what we normally do on Friday, about everything that we talked about this week. And we had an interesting week. We, of course, Monday, we got into kind of an emotional discussion because I brought up Jessica Chambers, the young woman who was walking down the street on fire. There hasn't been any new parts to this story that I've been able to find. Have you seen anything?
No, I'm actually trying to bring my internet up right now, so I'm gonna plug it in while we're talking. If anything pops up, I'll let you know.
Okay. Because I don't think I'm not watching TV here at the Institute, so normally my routine is to get up really early in the morning and watch the news. And I was trying to, that usually helps me figure out what's going on. One thing I do know, that FBI has joined in the hunt for the people that did this to this young woman. So I'm going to bring up that story just to let everybody know about that. But that's really the only thing I've heard. And, of course, the family is still torn and in a obviously very, very sad place.
The only thing I'm seeing with a bunch of the headlines, like from like less than a day ago, 14 hours ago, there's been a couple of posts by a couple of different news agencies. They're saying that I guess they had arrested a man, and but he's been cleared of all charges. Man cleared in Jessica Chambers' case, and the sheriff say no arrests are imminent. So that's a little disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI is joining the hunt, though. So now, if the FBI is involved in this, that makes me think that this is a bigger crime. That either this MO has happened before. Usually the FBI doesn't get involved in murders unless it crosses state lines or something like that. So I'm probably going to read this article later and see why the FBI is getting involved in her murder.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I know about that is this town is very, very small. There's like 500 people. And it's very scary because, you know, now everybody's, you know, fearing for their own safety. So that's one of the reasons. This article that I had brought up is the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the U.S. Marshals Service, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives are all involved in the investigation, said Panola County Sheriff Dennis Darby. His office remains in charge of the case. We have interviewed numerous people, and some we will even call a re-interview. The fire chief said Chambers made a dying statement to him, but he would not disclose what she said. Her sister told Reuters last week that Chambers had identified her killer before dying, but the sister has since declined further comment. The unsolved killing put the town of fewer than 500 people on edge. Well, I wonder why. And it's scary. You don't know who it was, and it could happen to anybody else. The Panola County District Attorney John Champion said there had been an unusual lack of street chatter about Chambers' death, but autopsy results and tests from the state crime lab expected later this week could help open up more leads. I've been in a lot of murder investigations. This one is one of the most bizarre that I've ever dealt with. So, and they have, you know, they have some pictures, and very sadly, they have a very beautifully decorated, almost antique-looking casket that they've put up pictures of, and a picture of her. So, it's, you know, obviously very, very sad. At a press conference on Thursday, the district attorney, John Champion, said they have spoken to many, many people, but he still feels like there's a lot that they don't know. In an emotional appeal ahead of her funeral, Jessica's father, Ben Chambers, said of the killer, "They just don't realize how they've messed up people's lives. You know, they took something from me that God gave me and that nobody can replace." Friends of Jessica's who attend the wake wore T-shirts branded with the phrase, "Justice for Jessica." Anybody with any type of information on Jessica will come forward, please, friend Heather Parker said via a radio station. The U.S. Marshals Service has announced $11,000 will be handed to the person that can offer crucial information. And the U.S. Marshals Service says the same thing twice. There's just not a lot of street talk out there about who may have or may not have done it. So they're circulating all kinds of rumors to see if anything can come up. It has emerged that the killer apparently got into the car before setting it alight. The teenager also had a large gash on her head. To piece together the last few hours of her life, the investigators continued to pore over surveillance footage from a gas station where she had been seen 90 minutes before her death. They're also looking at her cell phone, which was left behind at the scene. We're leaving no stone unturned at this point. This is an absolute horrendous case. The situation is about as bad as it becomes. The gas station surveillance footage shows her climbing out of her car, walking across the fort. Well, I read all that the other day, and that this particular thing, this particular video comes from the video camera in the store, and I would tell you it's not easy to see anything, but there's one shot with like three guys in the store, and she's over in the corner picking up whatever she went in the store to get, and then you see her walking back out, then she leaves the camera, and then you see her getting into her car, and the car... there's big pictures of the car. And the road where she was left is like, you know, like way back in the boonies, like being out near 140th in the acreage. You know, like that kind of in the outback kind of a place.
Right, right.
So, and the follow-up is, you know, about her. There's pictures of her mom and her dad and her. She's a cute little thing. And very sad, very, very, very sad. So we did that,
you know, what
on
happens
Monday.
When you hear stories like this, different types of murders, torture, people being imprisoned and things like that, I think that what happens to the vast majority of people, thankfully, because that means that we have a normal moral compass and we have normal sensitivities, or instead of saying normal, maybe I should say appropriate. I think what happens to the general population is that you go into a state of almost disbelief that another human being could perpetrate an act like this, because what you do instantly is you imagine yourself on both sides of the equation. First, you sympathize or empathize with the victim, and you see this happening to you, and you say, oh, my God, what a horrific thing to experience. And then you flip, and you see yourself on the other side of the equation perpetrating something like that on another human being, and you can't even bring yourself to imagine
having that kind of hate or having that kind of disturbing thoughts or having that kind of depravity, because it's so far afield from anything that's decent or like I said, I don't like using the word normal, but let's say appropriate or I have to use the word normal, you know, for whatever that means, for lack of a better word. And I think that's what happened. And you hear stories like this, I mean, because that's what I struggle with when I hear cases of extreme violence, where if you're so angry that you kill someone in a passionate moment, although that's a horrific act, it's and I'm not saying it's understandable in a way that it's okay, but it's understandable when things happen in a heat of a moment because people aren't acting rationally. But when we see acts of violence or when we see neglect that goes on for months or years or abuse that goes on for months or years, these are repetitive acts. These aren't done in the passion of the moment. This is somebody whose mind just works that way. That's, I think, what's so disturbing to the general population is because they try to grapple with that. How do you have a human that grows up, you know, whether they're 17 or 70, to be able to perpetrate that on somebody else? What happened to them that made them so almost inhuman? Because as far as I'm concerned, that's an inhuman act to do that to somebody else. And that's what I grapple with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I can't imagine any normal. As you say, we're not really sure anymore what normal is, but our quick assessment of the word normal would mean, you know, pretty much like everybody else. And I don't think most people would. I don't think most people could even conceive perpetrating a crime like that on anybody, even somebody that they're trying to get even with, which is sometimes the most horrendous crimes, when somebody's been hurt by somebody else and they lash out. You see couples and you see family members. Look at Thanksgivings ago, where the man who had struggled with his mental health his whole life and showed up at the big, quite large family festivities for Thanksgiving and killed everybody at the table.
Right,
just about
right,
everybody.
I remember.
You
that
know?
Story. Yep.
So a lot of times it has to do with, you know, old damage and old stuff that never gets worked through. And, of course, we
right.
talk about that a lot on the show. We talk about letting go. We talk about who is hurt most by hanging on to stuff like that. It's never the person you're angry with, you know, so you're not doing anything to hurt them. You're just doing something to hurt yourself. And, of course, there's a million stories we could touch on that's exactly the story. You know, somebody hurts somebody else, and the get-even syndrome settles in, and to get even, they hurt somebody else, and then they never let go of it either. So,
right.
But this kind of a crime, I don't know, with all the shows we watch and all the times we talk about all this kind of brutality that's going on in our world out there, you have to make the assumption that whoever perpetrated this particular crime, first of all, was very upset with this young woman, and secondly, is struggling with their own mental health. I mean, whether or not that's an excuse, I don't want to debate, and I don't think it should be, but that's for the courts of law to decide. But you have to not be normal. Again, because we discussed this on Monday, we talked about my grandson, and I often think of the three boys that are in jail and have been there. I mean, their time in jail is almost half over already, and Michael is still struggling with everything. So the punishment for a crime like that is hard to, it's hard to decide. Obviously, if Michael had died as a result of those boys' actions, I'm pretty sure nothing would have mattered. They'd have probably done life in jail.
Yeah,
but
I agree with that.
The fact that he survived of course, changed it. But in our eyes, the family's eyes, it didn't change anything. Really didn't change anything. I mean, we're thrilled, we'll be forever grateful that he survived it, but we're still thinking about the act itself. And, of course, we've been very open about not about it being punishment for the boys, and we didn't put a lot of energy into all of that. But when you think about teaching the lessons that we're trying to teach to the young people today, one of the things you and I talk about all the time, how do you say to a seven-year-old who's related to my grandson, a cousin of his or one of his nieces or nephew, and you say, they say, well, what happened to the boys that hurt Uncle Mike or Cousin Mike or whatever? Well, they're in jail forever. That's what AJ said to me, forever, Grandma? And I said, no. And even at seven, he's bewildered as to why an action like that, at 7 years old, he's bewildered as to why an action like that didn't mean more.
Right.
You know, and you do have to wonder that. Again, it's not something that I'm out to do, and I don't believe in vengeance because they don't serve anybody. But you have to wonder when you're trying to teach a lesson or you're trying to stop something like that from ever happening again.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, you know, for some people it might be worth it to think they're only going to go to jail for 10 years to do something like that. I mean, think about that. Depending on how, what state their mental capacity is in and how angry they are with somebody. To do this to this young woman, somebody had to really, really either be really off their rocker or really, really mad at her, right?
Well, see,
I mean,
you would think. And that's where I struggle, because how could you be that angry with somebody to want them to die that way, or worse yet, want them to suffer like that way?
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, I don't understand angry enough with somebody to want them dead to begin with. I've never understood that. Well, I'm glad I don't. I'm glad I can't embrace that it makes no sense to me, you know. But there's a lot of people that I see that kind of anger well up in them where they can hurt another individual and they have absolutely no remorse. I don't understand that. I always talk on the show, but, you know, I'm always watching these judge shows. And I've seen some of these cases, and it's shocking, but this is on national television, and you'd think these people would at least try to hide their personalities a little bit. But I've seen cases where there were assaults, and the person who was assaulted and injured is now suing the person for their medical bills and for pain and suffering. And they get up, and then they go to the other individual, and they're like, well, they got up in my face, or they said that, or they said this, and they're so righteous. And the judge will even say, well, can't you see that now this person has this scar or is permanently injured? This one guy came there and he was permanently injured. He had done something to the guy's jaw and he's never going to be okay. This is like a thing he's going to have to live with the rest of his life. I don't know why he wasn't doing like a multi-million dollar lawsuit. He was only suing him for the jurisdictional limit of $5,000. That's what he was doing. And that judge even said that. Why are you in a small claims court over something like this? This is a major injury you suffered. And the guy who did it to him had zero remorse, didn't care. He got in his face over something, and he just pummeled him and had no remorse whatsoever that he had injured this guy so badly and literally changed his life over nothing. The argument that ensued was so petty and nonsensical, they both could have just walked away, but this guy wouldn't, you know. Mm-hmm. And you see, and it happens with women, too. In fact, sometimes the women are more vicious, which is even more shocking because you think it wouldn't be the case. And the same thing, the violence that comes up in people, men and women, is there's something aberrant about it in our society today. It's like there's just less of a respect for life for those particular individuals. I still think the vast majority of human beings on this planet, thank heavens, do respect life, do want to be kind. Unfortunately, the only thing that makes it to the news, because being kind isn't sensational, is all the bad acts that people do to each other. And it, sometimes mm-hmm. it makes you feel like it's more prevalent than it is, just because it's in the news every time you turn the TV on or pick up a paper. But it actually isn't. It's actually a very small cross-section of population worldwide. that does act like that, and it's but I struggle with it because it's just I don't understand where the violence is coming from.
Well, most of us that are, again, that all-encompassing word normal don't understand it. I mean, I actually don't understand how somebody can have a knockdown drag-out with somebody that they most of the time love, and yet that happens every day, every minute of every day. Husbands and wives kick the hell out of each other. Brothers kick the hell out of each other. Sisters, I mean, there's, for me, I've always believed that it was because things build up and people don't talk. Things get, you know, just one comment. I mean, it's happened to me before. Somebody in passing in an open forum with like several friends sitting and talking, and to be funny, somebody will say something, and it hurts you. And they say it in the form of a joke, and sometimes it's about you or yours, or just, you know, like something that would be considered, you know, just everybody in general about something like that, and they'll say something, and it kind of like gives a quick little stab to you, to your heart, to your soul, whatever you want to call it. And you don't say anything. You laugh like everybody else. But you walk away thinking, geez, you know, does she really feel that way about me? Or, geez, does she really think, you know, my husband is that way, or my kid is that way, or this? All those little things, and you never, ever talk about it. Those little festers can add up in somebody and bring them to that particular point. So I believe not everything is worth a discussion. I don't want to make it sound like that I believe that either. Some things you should be able to let, like, right over the top of your head and never give it another minute's thought. But if it can't, and you can't do that, then you got to talk to somebody about it, because it leaves, it plants a seed that can fester into a giant thing inside of you. And I just think talk is, I mean, the singly speaking most important thing you can do for your own mental health is to not hold things inside. Now, at the other institute, you and I met a lot of people who took those words and turn them into, I got to share everything from, you know, you said yesterday something to me, or the way you looked at me, or you didn't invite me here, or you put on Facebook this and that, and it hurt my feelings, and they take it to an extreme. I don't mean that. I mean things that really bother you because you think somebody feels some way about you, and you'd like the opportunity to say, that's not true, I don't feel that way, or I didn't do that, or I would never do that, or something. Those are the kind of things you have to empty back out again. So in a scenario that might be at least explain a little bit how somebody could do something this awful, it could even be something like that. What they did to my grandson, there was no good reason to do that. I mean, it was kid stuff, literally. And yet, it snowballed into something horrific. And maybe that's what happened with this guy. Who knows? Right? But I think that if you want to stop, or if you want to teach a lesson to a younger person, or maybe Jessica has younger brothers and sisters that doesn't really talk, well, it says a sister, talks about her sister. So she's got to deal with this now the rest of her life. If nobody's letting her talk and letting her get rid of some of the pain and suffering that she's going through, that's another mistake. So, I mean, there are things that should be being done, and for the parents. I mean, Mike and Val, for the beginning of when Mike got hurt, they were like zombies. You remember what I told you Mike said to me that next morning? Do you remember what he said to me, my own son?
No.
He kept like having like he'd stand up and he'd like start shaking all over a couple different times. Valerie and I would have to stand on both sides of him and just hug his body. And when we finally got home to my house that morning, well, about 10 o'clock, I told him he had to lay down, and I went to work. And he stood up to go into the bedroom, and he grabbed a hold of my shoulder, and he said, "Mom, if Mike dies, you have to shoot me."
Yes, I do remember that. Yeah, yep, I do remember that.
Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Michael, don't ever say anything like that to me again, and Mike's not going to die." Of course, I don't know how I knew that exactly, but it seemed like the right thing to say at the time. But,
yeah.
You know,
you
I'll never forget that.
Yep, yep. Yeah, I remember. Yeah, I mean, he went through so much, and I remember a couple other things he said, so I wasn't sure which you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But, yes, I do remember mm-hmm. when you shared that with me. And it was, and I can imagine feeling that way myself. You know, if you
yeah.
have a child, and especially because Mikey's their only child, I mean, sometimes
mm-hmm.
if something happens to a child and you have a big family, you almost have to be strong for the rest of your children. But
mm-hmm.
when it's your only child, and this is your life, because, you know, that's your legacy. Your children are your legacy. And now this child not only is harmed, but is just suffering so terribly. You know, you sit there and you feel like this.
You feel like your life is over. You feel like your life is over. I know that
right.
personally.
Life is over, and like you have to do something, and there's nothing for you to do. So you
yeah.
have two different.
Very frustrating.
You're struggling with if this goes bad, and my son or my daughter dies, then there's no purpose to my life anymore, because that was my life. And then on the other hand, you're sitting there going, "Oh, my God, I have to do something because this is my child. I have to make my child okay." Meanwhile, there is nothing you can do except pray and be faithful. And sometimes that's the most powerful thing that a parent or a friend can do for their loved one, is pray and be faithful, because I still believe very strongly that that's what pulled Michael through. You had so many people praying for him, and I
mm-hmm.
think he just massive... divine intervention, if you want to say, in getting to the point where he survived.
Well, on that note, and then we're going to move on, but on that note, I want to share with a few people something, what you just said about the power of prayer and the power of so many people all putting energy into the same arena. One night, this was probably at least 10 days into the trauma center and everything, and I'm at the hospital, and Michael's temperature had shot up to 106.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And it was very, very scary. And, of course, everybody comes running in because I said his temperature's sky high. Somebody's got to do something. Change the bandages, do the poultices, do whatever you do that can start bringing his temperature down. And they threw us all out. So Mike and Val went into their Ronald McDonald place, and I went to over the bridge to the apartment where one of my friends was letting me stay, an apartment she owns in Miami. So I'm going over the bridge, and I called Susan Lerner, I called you, I called Susie Ralston, I called all the people that I knew had large groups of people, and I said, "I'm not going to explain any of this to you right now, but I need every person sending out energy and prayers to Michael. He's in trouble tonight, and I need all the help I can get." I probably called a half a dozen people, and again, all people that I knew had big mailing lists, had big, you know, Susie Ralston is involved with a whole bunch of reverends and things like that, so she has like 300 of them that she works with on a regular basis. So all the people I chose to call, including family members, were people that I knew would do what I asked. By the time I got over the bridge, all the way over to A1A, Valerie called me and said that they called her from the trauma room, and Mike's temperature was down. Now, yes, they started proceedings. Yes, they started doing things to bring the temperature down. But I have always believed that's why his temperature came down, because all those people put all that energy in like 5 minutes' time, and within about 20 minutes, his temperature was where it needed to be.
Yeah.
So
and
for
I
what that's, yeah, I know you believe it, and you and I don't talk, excuse me, a lot about religion because it's a very controversial topic for most of us, and we don't talk a lot about it on the show. But love and prayer and good energy, you don't have to call that Catholicism, you don't have to call that Baptist, Protestant, Jewish, you don't have to call
right.
that anything except for the power of people.
Right, right.
You know?
And that's true. I'm glad that you said that, because when we say prayer, we're not talking any particular religion. All faiths pray, and it doesn't
uh-huh.
matter what, you know, like somebody we know used to say, what brand you put on it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it
mm-hmm.
doesn't matter where your particular faith lies and the specific doctrines you believe in. Prayer is prayer, regardless of who you're praying to. You know, prayer and faith is prayer and faith. And there doesn't have to be a name to that prayer and faith. That's all it is. It's very simple. It's all from love. It's from compassion. And it's healing. Love and compassion are always healing. And
yes.
I remember that when you had called me, I called my friends out in Oregon.
Yeah.
And this is why we literally were spanning the United States. Within 10 minutes of your phone call, I called friends of mine out there that are ministers. And they actually had a prayer group going with something like 35 people in Oregon within 15 minutes of you calling me. There were people on the other side of the country praying for Mikey, because they got their congregation in a phone group. They called
yep.
and they just kept getting people on the line, and they did a what's called a remote healing prayer for him from Oregon. So
mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
so it's massively powerful when you can have that kind of energy all directed at one individual.
Yeah. Well, and I believe with my heart and soul. I mean, yes, the technologies today are amazing, but, I mean, there was not any hope the night we arrived at Jackson Memorial. We were told
mm-hmm.
that there was
mm-hmm.
not much hope. So to prepare ourselves and to know and yet, survival is
mm-hmm.
what was accomplished. So,
before we go on to the next story,
just
because this is something good I think people should know about, I followed prayer sessions with people that had miraculous healings that were like against all odds. There was that woman in, I think it was Michigan, ironically enough.
Yeah.
It was either Michigan or Minnesota, but it was a very cold state. She was out. Her car broke down. She wasn't dressed for the winter. She ended up passing out in the cold, literally 100 feet from her friend's front door. They found her the next morning, and she had they thought she was dead. She was frozen.
Yeah.
Her eyes were open.
I remember that.
Yeah, her eyeballs were frozen. Her hands and her feet were black. They thought she was going to lose both her feet. The church came down there, and within an hour of her being admitted into ICU, there were dozens of people in the waiting room, actually at the hospital praying for her, and then there were dozens of people around the town praying for her. And the doctor said that he has never seen this. He said it's not possible. Black gangrene tissue cannot regenerate. And you could see the doctor was still baffled by this case. He said, I've never seen this happen. He said within 24 hours, the black moved down from her ankles, down her feet, down to her toes, her hands, and when she finally opened her eyes after she came out of it, she could see. And he says, I don't understand how this is possible. He said she should have been blind, she should have been brain damaged, and she should have lost both her feet. And nothing, not only, she didn't even lose a toe, nothing happened. She completely recovered. Full brain function, eyesight, both hands and feet intact. So
wow.
that's
I've read other stories like that, but in every case, and there were people that night that were not as severely frostbitten as her that succumbed, but they did not have a prayer group. So that's when this little light went on in this doctor's head, and he started researching faith healing and prayers. And he said, you know, and he said the comment you just did, he said, we have all this technology, he said, but there is absolutely a power greater than medicine and technology.
Right.
And
right.
he says, I think that prayer should always be matched up with medicine.
Mm.
And this is a medical doctor saying it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's been shown to me in a million different ways. So I got no problem with believing and understanding and embracing all of that. So, but we better move on to the next thing, because this will get us both talking about a lot of different things, and that's, of course, the Bullies to Buddies show on Tuesday. And I shared the two stories that I found in a magazine about kids. The first story was about a young girl who hides the fact that she's cutting her thighs from her mom and realizes that she, she's got major, major issues and doesn't want to tell anybody. And when she finally confides in her mother, the mom tries to help her. But the mom realizes that the first episode was when she was very, very young. And instead of really taking seriously, I think was the issue, that her daughter came home and said that girls were picking on her, and she said, stand up for yourself, all the things that we've all been taught to say, don't let them bother you or ignore them or all the things that we've all said before. And she thought when the daughter quit talking to her about it that it got better, you know, because she had some friends and everything seemed okay. And then when she realized that that's not what was happening, she was already totally engulfed in a world of depression and self-harm. So, and according to the story, which I have trouble knowing that she still cuts herself, even as a mom, as a adult that has grown past all that stuff. And the woman writes that she knows she still cuts herself, but it's her release. And something about that just leaves this, if you'll forgive it's almost like the wound is still opened.
Right.
And that really bothers me. There's coping taking place. There's living with an issue taking place. But there's no closure on something that's really awfully sad. And that really bothered me. I thought about that the whole rest of the day and the next day, and I read another article very similar, and I thought, it's like, I don't know. And so does that really mean, and I don't know, because every story I read was a little bit different, but I can't tell you that any of the research I did told me that it was ever a done deal and they didn't do it anymore.
Well, one girl I was talking about, the one that I had, like I said, it was ironic that I had seen this court show, and then literally the next day we're doing a story about a girl who's cutting herself. So remember I talked about that young girl who was being bullied, started cutting herself, and she was going to commit suicide, and her mother got wind of it and stopped it and got her therapy, and she's not cutting anymore. And
she isn't.
She's,
how do you know that for sure, honey?
Well, because she talks about it quite openly. She said that's why she's running this campaign to stop bullying. She has no issue wearing short sleeve shirts and stuff like that to show people and things like that. But she talked quite openly about it, that once she got a handle on what had happened to her, she didn't have the desire to cut herself anymore. And now she wants to stop other kids from going there. So she has this whole anti-bullying campaign. And for kids, she said what would have helped her is if the other kids would have joined in to the bullies and said, hey, knock it off, that's not cool. But she said what happens is you have cliques of kids. Some of them basically just walk away and ignore it because they don't want to get involved, and others almost stand there like they're supporting the bully, you know. So what she's trying to, she has a thing, she said, stand up against bullying. Like, if you see it happening, say something. Let the let the kid, don't make it a cool thing, or, you know, these kids feel power when they're bullying. So if they're bullying somebody and everybody else around them says, hey, knock it off, that's not cool, now they're going to be embarrassed and it's going to dwindle them down. But when people just stand around and watch them, it's almost like passive approval of what they're doing, and they think that
they think they're
gaining power and respect and all this other nonsense, which they're not. They're just, people are just afraid of them, which is not a good thing to inspire in people, because the minute somebody's not afraid of you, you're in trouble. It's much better to have somebody respect and love you, because then they will put themselves on the line for you if they respect and love you. But if they're if they're afraid of you, they're only going to behave towards you the way you want while they're afraid. The millisecond they're no longer afraid of you, now they're going to turn on you. So that's why I would rather have people love and respect me, because that's permanent.
Well, and it's just also much better energy, period. I mean, you know, for everybody concerned. So
yeah. I have heard, I've seen some of these talk shows and read some of the articles where some of these kids do recover completely from the desire to cut and things like that. But it takes the right kind of counseling. It has to take a willingness on themselves, just like a drug addict, because it is another form of addiction, okay? But it does take, you know, a level of commitment on their part to be willing to give that up, because it becomes almost habitual, becomes almost like an addiction. So they have to participate in the therapy to release that.
Well, that I think that's the issue. And then when, because I mean, you know, how many alcoholics do you know pretend that they're not drinking or lie about their drinking? Or how many drug users hide in a closet to get high? I mean, it's not something, any of those things are not stuff that everybody is proud of. So I'm just wondering if there's really that kind of recovery. I googled it just now.
And the way you can tell that cutting, more than any other of these, you can't hide. You know, if you have scars all over your body that you can tell are months and months old, and they're scarring over, then this person isn't actively cutting. If they're actively cutting, they're going to have open cuts. So this is something you can absolutely prove whether or not somebody is abstained from or not. Not like, you know, alcohol and drugs, you have to take blood work and all this other stuff. But cutting is evidence. You look at their arms and their legs, and either they have fresh wounds or they don't. And there's a lot of kids that don't have fresh wounds anymore, and they have actually gotten past that. And because you can tell, because their scars get older and older and older, and you can tell by looking at them how long it's been since they actively cut.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to believe that, but I think if they really want to, there's a place where they can hide it. I mean, the mom in the story I read Tuesday, she never knew, because the kid cut herself way up on the tops of her thighs, and the mother never knew. I mean, there's a time when you quit seeing your child unclothed and things like that, and there is a way for them to hide it, and there is a way for them to hide it from everybody if they really want to. So I'm going to have to, let's research this, Shell, and let's see.
There were being seen by doctors that were cleared and that now talk about it, and they'll wear a bathing suit in front of you. I mean, they show you that they're not actively cutting anymore. There have been cases where they have permanently recovered from that, and they no longer have they don't feel that need to, but it's because they participate, and this is what they say. They participated in the counseling, and they allowed themselves to get a better self-image. Part of the reason they were cutting is because they allowed other people's opinions of them or criticisms of them to put them in a place where they felt lesser of themselves.
And once they rose above that, they didn't feel the need to self-harm anymore. And these are the kids that now, or now they're, some of them are adults, these are now the kids are adults that now want to help other people that are going through the same thing, that, yes, there is light at the end of the tunnel. You can get over this. Look how well I'm doing now. But you have to participate in your counseling. And they're very outspoken about it.
Mm-hmm. Let me read this, because this is good news, I think. This is from an institute, Self-Injury Statistics, Causes, and Signs and Symptoms. It's an organization that helps, and there's a confidential number and stuff like that. But it says, as self-injury frequently occurs in private, my computer is jumping all over the place like it's having some kind of a reaction to what I'm doing. Okay. As self-injury frequently occurs in private, rates of self-harm are difficult to determine. Estimates vary widely from 3% to 38% in adolescents and young adults. Studies conducted with university students demonstrated a 17% lifetime prevalence rate in this population, with 13% reporting that they had engaged in self-harm more than once. Studies of high school students indicated prevalence rates of self-harm in this population ranged from 13 to 24%. Onset can occur in children as young as 7 years old, but the age of onset is usually between the ages of 12 and 15. Self-injury may also begin during the college years, with surveys reporting that 30 to 40% of college students report engaging in self-harm after the age of 17. So it says there are a number of mental health disorders that co-occur with self-injurious behaviors. The most mm-hmm. frequently co-occurring comorbid mental health disorders may include trauma, anxiety, bipolar, autism, borderline personality disorder, all these kind of things that often go with it. And these are supposed to be statistics, but they're just telling me the statistics of how many kids cut themselves. They're not telling me too much about, you know.
Well, see, that makes a lot of sense to me, that they say it's a co-occurring, mm-hmm. you know, condition, because that course that I had gone through on addictionology talked about co-occurring diagnoses that, for the most part, people that have addictive behavior, and cutting is addictive, by the way. It's an addictive type mm-hmm. of behavior, like bulimia and different conditions like that, that they usually, it's usually more complicated than that. There's usually several different co-occurring diagnoses, and each one of these symptoms basically feed the other one. So you it's almost like you have a perfect storm of instability that create behavior of that individual. So you can't just treat the cutting without looking at what else is playing a role into pushing them to that. Because wanting to self-harm is not, that's not an appropriate reaction to anything. And it's certainly not an appropriate reaction to somebody saying something bad to you about yourself, because that should instill self-preservation. Where is the self-preservation in these people? It's lacking. Why is it lacking? So there's something deeper seated there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is also kind of upsetting, but I'm going to read it anyway, just in case somebody's out there and is worried about something that's going on. This little bit of information might help. There's a lot of what they refer to as common types of self-harm. Cutting is number one. Sticking objects into the skin, banging the head against a hard surface. Now, we've done a lot of shows about autism and things like that, and that is a side effect a lot of times in the real young autistic children. Scalding or burning oneself.
Mm.
Trichotillomania, which is pulling out your hair. And
I've heard of that one.
Yeah, yeah, and I knew somebody like that when I was real young. Hitting oneself with a hard object, such as a hammer, skin picking or pulling off scabs, intentionally interfering with the healing of a wound, swallowing poison or other inappropriate objects, and there are even some young people that start breaking the bones in their hands and their feet. It's, you know, intentionally breaking the bones.
Did it last
breaking,
one?
Breaking bones in their hands and feet.
Oh, that one I've never heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
the all
one
the
I've
other
never
ones I've heard of. I've never heard of that one.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So, I guess the biggest lesson we can take from this, and the story that we did on Tuesday, and of course we've talked about cutting in the past, and we will probably talk about it again. You need to really pay attention to your kids. You really need to pay attention to them. And if 1 minute they come to you and they're really upset about something and it's really an issue for them, and just out of the blue they get over it and they're not talking to you about it anymore, you need to dig a little deeper. You need
right.
to see what's going on. Because things that really, really upset them today, I don't mean just they're mad or they're angry or something like that. Yes, kids get over those things quite simply. But if it's a major issue and all of a sudden one day there's no more talk about it, nobody says anything, you say something about, you know, what about so-and-so? Is she still picking on you? Yeah, it's no problem. You better find out what's going on. Because if they
mm-hmm.
fixed it by themselves, they might be doing this to fix it. So I guess that's the only thing that we can give in respect to that, to, you know, to enlighten all of us about paying attention to that. Now, yesterday, the show we did was fun. We brought Michael in, and he and I talked it. Oh, I could use a few English lessons this morning. Talked about it last night again, and he said it was kind of fun. And I said, well, I said it is, because all of us are impassioned by the things that we enjoy doing. Everybody is. And, of course, we have all been very blessed in finding our way to things that reward us in little small ways. And, of course, Michael and his wheatgrass and what he understands about the oxygen and the green food and all that kind of stuff, and realizes that it's kind of like magic in some ways. So who wouldn't get excited about that? So we talked about this institute. We talked about the institute that we all worked at for so long. And we didn't touch on something that we came across the other night in discussing, you know, how we're doing this and how we're doing that. There are new rules in regard to sprouting. Now, for those of you who don't know what sprouting is, you take a seed, you put it in some water and soak it. Then you pour all the water off and you rinse the seeds. And you do that for a couple days. And you do several fresh water and new rinsing. And then the little seed, you know, starts to grow and a little sprout. If you're in, sometimes in kindergarten and first grade, they teach the kids about this and they plant them in soil. And then you see the little sprout come out of the seed and start to grow, right? Well,
mm-hmm.
well, in vegan lifestyles, you eat a lot of those seeds right after they sprout. You eat them like that, in the seed form with a little sprout coming out of them.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to, it's, you know, it's like germination, and you have to keep them rinsed. Well, apparently somewhere down the line through the last few years, somebody got sick on sprouts and went to the health department and the Better Business Bureau. And the Better Business Bureau alerted the health department, and the health department was already alerted. So they started looking into the procedure to sprout. So it appears as though when you soak the seed, pour the water off, soak the seed, they want the water tested to see if during the germination and the soaking of the water, if any bacteria results in that water. Well, now, pretty sure it does. Pretty sure it does, because you have live food sitting in water, so I'm pretty sure there's some, not just the beauty of the seed sprouting, there probably is some germs, which doesn't surprise me since they're germinating. So Michael has a little saying that he says it's like, you know, they're like babies, and when they start to sprout, it's like they poop, so you got to change the diaper. That's why you rinse the water and change the water. The health department guy thought that was kind of amusing, but he didn't let us do it anyway. What they want you to do is they want you to use bleach. A little tiny bit of bleach in the soak water in the germination and sprouting of these seeds. So Michael and I both stared at him and said, what, are you crazy? And he said, well, that little bit of bleach isn't going to hurt anybody. There's a little tiny bit of chlorine and stuff like that in drinking water and this and that. I said, we know that. We deal with that kind of thing all the time. And I looked at him and I said, and by the way, many, many years ago, I got Clorox poisoning, and it's no fun. I broke out every place, because the chlorine got into my bloodstream. And thank God there was a good doctor in town. Otherwise, I would have thought, I don't know what I'd have thought. I mean, even my breasts and everything got covered in like little sores. It was awful, Shell. And it was from rinsing.
Yeah, you told me about this.
Yeah, rinsing the claws to keep a restaurant clean. And you soaked them in bleach.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember times when I didn't feel like I had fingerprints because my hands got so slimy from the breakdown from the bleach. So when I told him that, and he says, I said, what about food-grade peroxide? Well,
now
we're discussing that. You know, that's in. We've seen that, and people are talking about that and everything, and that might work. So what we ended up deciding is we're not going to sprout. We're going to plant the seeds, and just like we do the sunflower and the pea shoots, we're going to plant everything and just keep them micro, you know, keep them small plants, and that's how we're going to put those on the salad bar. So we don't have to worry about those rules. And there are some schools of thought as those being even healthier than the germinated seed. So we didn't talk about that yesterday, but I wanted to let everybody know, especially those that are out there doing this kind of thing. And, of course, if you're doing it at home, nobody's going to bother you. So if you enjoy a sprouted, I mean, fenugreek is an awesome, and mung and lentils and all those things. And we used to have giant bowls of those on the buffet.
Well, the bottom line is food-grade peroxide absolutely works perfectly. If you grow the sprouts properly and ventilate it and have the proper lighting on it, you will not get the mold, you will not get the bacteria. So there are ways of growing sprouts safely and correctly. There are places that don't do it properly, and it's a shame that you have an organization that comes in that doesn't understand sprouting that has to make rules about it. This is one of the reasons I have a problem with the FDA and organizations like that, because they make rulings on things that they really don't understand. They say things are safe that aren't safe, like they approve the Sperotime, right? And then they say things aren't that are, like supplements and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I have an issue
with
that.
Well, I got to say, on behalf of the health department here in Michigan, the men that we've dealt with are incredibly open-minded, openly admit to the fact that this is all foreign to them, and really, really nice, and willing to research and find out if what we're talking about is right on. But for the interim, we won't do sprouts like that. We'll get buckwheat and stuff like that from places that have already passed all the inspections. But we're out of time. I want everybody to know that I am going back to Florida tomorrow morning, and so there won't be a show tomorrow morning. I'll be en route home. I really, really miss my family and my friends. And I'll be there for Christmas, but the grand soft opening for Vibrant Health Institute will be January 18th. And again, if you are interested in coming here and spending a week, 3 weeks, 6 weeks, give me a call. It's going to be really exciting. I've already accepted a lot of reservations. I already talked to some amazing people that I can't wait to meet in person. So this is going to be a whole new year, a whole new story, a new chapter in my book and in Shelley's book. So everybody go out there and have a great day today, and I hope you stay warm. Yesterday was the first day it was really, really cold here. So, and it snowed a little bit last night, but today seems a little bit better. Or maybe I'm acclimating quickly. I doubt that, but I'm going to put that out there just in case. And I lost my favorite gold bracelet, so everybody put out some good vibes that I find it today. It broke
Aww.
My heart. I try not to get too
find
attached
it. You'll
to
find
material
it.
Things. Yes, I know. I will, right? Let's put it out
yep.
there. Thanks, everybody. Love you, Shell. I'll see you when I get home.
All right. Love you too, sweetie. Great show, and we'll speak to everybody next week. Have a safe
okay.
trip back, hon.
Thank you, babe. Bye-bye, everybody. Bye. God bless.